Hi, welcome to Cochrane Alliance Church and our online sermons. We are so glad you are able to join us. We pray that this sermon will be a blessing and an encouragement to you this week.
We're coming into Ruth chapter 2. And one time, an anthropologist named Margaret Mead, who's kind of a famous anthropologist in the mid-1900s, she was asked by a student, what in her mind would be the first sign of civilization in a culture? And the student expected Margaret to talk about fish hooks or clay pots or grinding stones or agricultural methods, but none of those things. Mead said that the first sign of civilization in an ancient culture was if you found a skeleton with a femur bone that had been broken and then healed. And Mead explained that, of course, in the animal kingdom or in an uncivilized culture, if you break your leg, you die. Because you cannot run from danger, you can't get to the river for a drink, you can't hunt for food. You're just meat for prowling beasts. No animal survives a broken leg long enough for bones to heal. So a broken femur that has been healed is evidence that someone has taken time to stay with the person who has fell, has bound up that wound, and has carried that person to safety, and then tended that person through recovery. And so this idea, then, that a civilization should be judged on how it cares for its most vulnerable and its poorest people has been echoed by people like Gandhi or Nelson Mandela. And the core belief is that a nation's greatness cannot be measured by how it treats its most outstanding or its most powerful citizens, but by how it acts as a steward towards those on the margins, those who are the most vulnerable. Now, in ancient Israel, there is a code of laws. And we can read these laws in Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy. And these laws cover numerous topics, but like all great civilizations, these laws regarding how the nation were about how to treat the poor and the vulnerable among them. I mean, there's a whole bunch of laws, but there's a certain subsection of these laws, which is what do you do with the poor? What do you do with the widow? What do you do with the orphan? How do you treat the most vulnerable in your society? And so as we come back into the story of Ruth and Naomi, we remember that Naomi and Ruth enter Bethlehem penniless, husbandless, and for Ruth, she is now the foreigner. She is now the immigrant, and she's not coming from a well-loved country. She's coming from Moab, a country that ancient Israelites detested and hated and had constant warfare with. So this isn't really a great situation. And of course, their first concern is food. How are Ruth and Naomi going to eat when they have no money? What are they possibly going to do? And here is where they rely on the laws of Israel to help them survive. The law of Moses stated things like this. When you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Do not go over your vineyard a second time or pick up grapes that have fallen. Leave them for the poor and the foreigner. I am the Lord your God. In Deuteronomy, we come into this. When you are harvesting in your field and you overlook a sheaf, do not go back to get it. Leave it for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow, so that the Lord your God may bless you in the work of your hands. When you beat the olives from your trees, do not go over the branches a second time. Leave what remains for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow. When you harvest the grapes in your vineyard, do not go over the vines again. Leave what remains for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow. So this gathering of the leftover, overlooked, forgotten food products from the harvest, and some of it was intentionally overlooked. Like, you know when you're picking the olives from your tree that you're going to miss a few. And the Lord says, don't go pick it a second time. Those ones that you missed are for the poor. Don't harvest right to the edges of your field. Make sure you leave that. Well, that's called gleaning. The people who come in to take what is left behind, they're gleaning it. And we can think of gleaning as Israel's welfare system. It's a way for the poor, the widow, the orphan, the refugee, the foreigner, to sustain themselves by scavenging the leftover grain or olives or grapes. That's what Ruth and Naomi are counting on as their way of surviving. And gleaning, while it's a decent way of caring for the poor in that type of ancient society, you shouldn't see that as any way thriving in your life. Robert Hubbard kind of puts it like this, like the gleaning of fallen grain is mere subsistence living. Much like trying to eke out survival by recycling aluminum cans. Okay, so that's more what this is like. You're able to survive, you're not going to thrive. In Israel, for someone like Naomi, who was once a respected member of the Bethlehem community, it must have been a pretty big blow to her sense of dignity to have her daughter-in-law join the ranks of the gleaners. It's like, we're going to collect bottles every day and hope we get enough money that we can eat. So remember where we left Naomi from last week. She is convinced that God's has said love for her has evaporated. In fact, she is convinced that God has actively turned against her. From Naomi's perspective, And again, this is just her perspective. It appears that God has destroyed her life, and she has, in a sense, given up on that life. Remember what she says when she comes home. "Don't call me pleasant, call me bitter. The Lord has turned against me." This is where she's at. So Naomi is fairly depressed and a little bit checked out of life as we begin our text. We're in Ruth chapter 2. Now Naomi had a relative on her husband's side, a man of standing from the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor." Naomi said to her, "Go, my daughter." Given her despair and her bitterness, we shouldn't be surprised that Naomi's not even bothering to join Ruth in the gleaning. She kind of gives what I would seems to read like a fairly apathetic assent to Ruth's suggestion to go and glean the favors. "Go ahead, my daughter." Now, Ruth went out. She entered a field and began to glean behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she was working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. Now, just pause here for a second. We should remember that Ruth is not totally safe. There's a danger to Ruth as a foreign woman gleaner. And this event is happening in the days of Judges, when Israel was often found violating the Lord's commands and doing whatever they saw was right in their own eyes. Right? So just because there's laws of the land does not mean Ruth can trust them. There's a danger here. Carolyn James points out that there's danger in two different ways. First, Ruth faces dangers from other hungry gleaners who are scrambling for the scant gleanings left behind. The presence of another gleaner in the field means less for everyone else. And that barley field could easily become something like a battlefield as gleaners competed and fought over limited resources. Young, female, foreign, presumably wearing garments that mark her as a widow, Ruth becomes an easy target for greedy gleaners who might choose to just take whatever grain she managed to collect. Now remember, we're coming off the tail of a big famine in the land, a decades-long famine. So there is most likely a lot of people looking to glean as they've lost their land, lost their homes, lost their livelihoods, and this is where they find themselves. Second, she faces danger at the hands of the hired harvesters. Harvesters occupied a fairly low level in Bethlehem's kind of power structure, but gleaners were even lower than the harvesters. And harvesters might find it tempting to take out their resentment on gleaners by pulling rank and mistreating them. There is always that tendency in humans, right, to pass your pain and frustration onto somebody else, onto those who are less fortunate. And so for a young and defenseless woman like Ruth, the possibility of being robbed or beaten or assaulted in any number of ways is present, even in the fields of Boaz. And you're going to see Boaz mentions the safety aspect, and Naomi mentions the safety aspect. I'm not just making this up. This is something that she has to consider. So Ruth recognizes that she is at risk of abuse or exploitation, and she needs to find a person's field and a person to glean behind in whose eyes she may find favor, as she says to Naomi. But as it turned out, she gleans in the field of the wealthy, distant relative by marriage, Boaz. Is this chance, or is it God's providence that Ruth just so happens to find herself in Boaz's field? The narrator does not say that God directs Ruth to Boaz's field, but that's the conclusion that we should find implied. John Hamblin puts it like this: the statement that Ruth happened to arrive at Boaz's field opens our understanding to the possibility that the hand of a loving God may be present in the events of our lives, even when we may feel, like Naomi, that God has turned against us. Like Esther, as we saw in our Esther series, the hidden hand of God is at work in Ruth's life, and the chesed love of God will be lived out by Boaz, Ruth's relative through marriage, into Elimelech's family. Just then, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. "The Lord be with you." "The Lord bless you," they answered. Boaz asked the overseer of the harvesters, "Who does that young woman belong to?" The overseer replied, "She is a Moabite who came back from Moab with Naomi. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters.'" You're going to find out that's an odd request. "She came into the field and has remained here from morning till now, except for a short rest in the shelter." She's a hard worker. She's been going from morning till now. So Boaz said to Ruth, "My daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field. Don't go away from here. Stay here with the women who work for me. Watch the field where the men are harvesting and follow along after the women. I have told the men not to lay a hand on you." Boaz is concerned about it as well. "And whenever you are thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars that the men have filled." What you have to understand is the scene is introducing Boaz as like this towering figure. Hael is the Hebrew word the narrator uses to describe Boaz. And it indicates that he's a man of valor, of stature, of wealth, of privilege, of power. When you hear the word Hael to describe someone, you should think of an elite warrior, like hero person, but with the character and the morals to match. So think of someone like Captain America, or even better, Pastor Phil as Captain America. And I would just say, Phil, if you would grow that beard out again a little bit, we could buy you beard oil if you want. But something like that, okay, that's Hael. That is a warrior, leader, hero type of person, but also squeaky clean, treats everyone with respect, heroic, a man others look up to as an example of what it is to be a man. Now, from Ruth's perspective, she doesn't know anything about Boaz, doesn't know his character, doesn't know his morals. Boaz simply represents power. And the disparity between Ruth and Boaz is obvious, and we're supposed to notice how unequal this situation is. You have a foreign-born woman from Moab, the hated Moabites, with no power, and an Israelite man in his own fields with everything. And the story is intended to kind of pose this question to us: what will Boaz do with his power? Now, Boaz is an honorable man. He complies with the Mosaic law. He permits gleaners in his fields. But Ruth doesn't want to just take home scraps to her mother-in-law. Remember, Ruth is not just gleaning for herself. She's got to get enough stuff in one day to feed herself and Naomi. So she apparently made this bold and maybe even outrageous proposal to Boaz's overseer. Remember that the overseer reported to Boaz, remarking on this foreign woman's boldness. She said, "Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters." So instead of scavenging for snippets of grain way after everything has been gathered, she wants to glean right behind the harvesters, like right where the freshly cut grain is lying on the ground. That's not normally a place gleaners are supposed to go. You're supposed to like wait your turn, wait until the kind of field is cleared out, and then you go and gather the little scraps that are left. But she wants to be right on the heels of the harvesters. Like, I'm almost grabbing them right out of their hands if I can. That's boldness. So I don't want you to overlook the courageousness of Ruth to ask this. She's never been in this country. She doesn't know anybody here, but she's bold to ask for what she needs. She makes a startling request. Carolyn James kind of sums it up like, Ruth lives on the hungry side of the law. And the law looks very different from that point of view. Her proposal is pressing Boaz beyond the letter of the law to fulfill the spirit of the law. The letter of the law says, let them glean. The spirit of the law is, feed them. Her brazen request creates this healthy conflict of interest for Boaz, as it should. The gleaning law doesn't ever specify how wide is the edge of your field, how big is a corner you're supposed to leave behind, how scrupulously the harvesters are supposed to like grab every little thing. And so undoubtedly, landowners are always kind of wrestling with, how much do I actually leave behind? How much of the edge of my field do I leave? Do I leave an inch? Do I leave a foot? Do I leave 5 feet? What is an edge? And keep in mind, this is the first good harvest after years of famine. And so you can imagine the harvesters are reluctant to leave anything behind. This is the first really good harvest they've had. They want everything to keep for themselves. Instead of taking offense at Ruth's boldness, Boaz's response to her is as radical as Ruth's request. This native-born Israelite who grew up on Mosaic law listens to this newcomer's request and throws his power behind her effort. He's obviously committed to God's law, but his actions here and later at the threshing floor demonstrate his willingness to adopt an even broader interpretation of the law. So what does Boaz do with his power? He protects this foreign woman and goes above and beyond the letter of the law. Boaz tells her, don't go to any other field, stay with him. He promises he has told the men not to lay a hand on her. So in case you thought I was exaggerating the danger Ruth may have been in, Boaz gets it. He says, in his fields, with the men he commands, he will guarantee Ruth's safety. He will also allow her to go to territory normally off limits to gleaners, right behind the harvesters, and you can even get water that the men have drawn from the well. You don't have to go and get your own. You're welcome to the provisions that we have. Now, Boaz is being incredibly generous and gracious. Ruth knows this, so we read, at this, she bowed with her face to the ground, and she asked him, why have I found favor in your eyes that you would notice me, a foreigner? Boaz replied, I've been told all about what you've done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. I think Boaz kind of sees his role as being a part of the Lord repaying her for her kindness. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. I think Boaz is kind of seeing as he is the representative of Yahweh to this Moabite woman. right? He's the one who has the power to richly reward her in the eyes of the Lord. "May I continue to find favor in your eyes, my Lord," she said. "You have put me at ease by speaking kindly to your servant, though I do not even have the standing of one of your servants." Then Boaz goes further. Not only does he protect this Moabite woman and allow her safe access to prime areas of the fields, but he then invites Ruth to leave her place of separateness as a foreign gleaner to join the community for a meal. At mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come over here, have some bread and dip it in the wine vinegar." When she sat down with the harvesters, he offered her some roasted grain. She ate all that she wanted and had some left over. As she got up to glean, Boaz gave orders to his men, "Let her gather among the sheaves and don't reprimand her. Even pull out some stalks from the bundles and leave them for her to pick up and don't rebuke her." Boaz continues to break with custom when, as the male head of the community, he serves Ruth, invites her to the table. I don't know if you've ever been in that situation where you walk into a place and you don't know anyone and everyone else knows everyone, right? Everyone knows each other and you're the only one who doesn't know anybody. How great is it when somebody who clearly is one of the leaders in the group says, "Hey, you got to come over here and join us." And they engage you in the conversation, engage you in that, and you become a part of that community. That's what Boaz is doing here. He's bringing her in to the community. And he serves Ruth enough roasted grain to satisfy her hunger and even have leftovers for Naomi. And Boaz's remarkable hospitality to the Moabite gleaner, as one commentator suggests, is not just about feeding the hungry. Rather, it shows how Boaz took an ordinary occasion and transformed it into a glorious demonstration of compassion, generosity, and acceptance. The biblical understanding of chesed love lived out in real life. Boaz continues to demonstrate chesed by adding to his earlier directive that the men not lay a hand on Ruth with a double order. First, that they not humiliate her, but that they make Ruth's gleaning easier by even pulling out some stalks from the bundles. Chesed is a power word in the Bible. It's the most important word in the book of Ruth. Now, chesed only shows up actually three times in the book of Ruth, but the concept of chesed runs through the entire story and drives the action of the entire book. Ruth is a lived-out example of what chesed love looks like in action. So in last week's sermon, I gave a definition of chesed love. I said chesed is a love that will not give up. It will not abandon. It will lay itself down for the good of the other. It is not the thrill of romance, but the security of faithfulness. A love that is always there, ready to persist beyond any sin or betrayal to mend brokenness and graciously extend forgiveness. And the problem with defining chesed love is that we have no real English equivalent for the powerful type of love chesed is trying to describe. We use, if you ever find words in your Bible like unfailing or kindness, or mercy, or loyalty, or loving kindness, they're often translating the word chesed into one of those words. Because while these words touch on aspects of chesed, they never fully capture what is meant by it. And chesed is the way God has always intended human beings to live together, from the very beginning. Chesed is the love your neighbor as yourself type of living. It's an active, selfless, sacrificial caring for one another that goes against the grain of our fallen natures. Chesed is a costly brand of love that involves going above and beyond what anyone has the right to ask or expect. It's the brand of love that's at work in the actions of Ruth and Boaz and ultimately in the life of Naomi as well. God is the ultimate chesed giver. The book of Ruth puts God's chesed on display. And we're going to learn along with Naomi that God's chesed love is indiscriminate, unearned, and persistent. God's chesed will reach Naomi through the selfless and relentless commitment of Ruth to fight for her, and Boaz will join Ruth in this effort. Events in the field of Boaz on this day will give Naomi fresh insight into God's chesed, his unfailing love. And remember, Naomi has thought God has failed her. Naomi is convinced that God is actively against her. But the actions that take place in the field on this day are going to change everything for Naomi. So not only does Boaz demonstrate genuine chesed love for Ruth, but in caring so well for Ruth, Naomi's broken heart is going to be moved by this tangible display of love from Boaz. It says, Ruth gleaned in the field until evening. Then she threshed the barley she had gathered, and it amounted to about an ephah. That's a lot. It's like a good size amount. I can't remember how many pounds. It's like a good amount. She carried it back to town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she had gathered. Ruth also brought out and gave what she had left over after she'd eaten enough of the roasted grain. Her mother-in-law asked her, "Where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one at whose place she had been working. "The name of the man I worked with today is Boaz," she said. "The Lord bless him," Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. "He has not stopped showing his kindness, hased," that's the literal word there, "to the living and the dead." She added, "That man is our close relative. He is one of our guardian redeemers." So Naomi is shocked by the abundance of food that Ruth brings home. She immediately knows Ruth did not gather all this without help. And she asks her, "Where were you today? Blessed be the man who took care of you." When she learns that the man is Boaz, her excitement increases. "The Lord bless him. He has not stopped showing his kindness, his hased, to the living and the dead." Quick note here. In the Hebrew text, that "he" is ambiguous. "He has not stopped showing his hased to the living and the dead." Is she referring to Boaz, or is she referring to God? It actually could go either way. There's ambiguity here. And so we actually would say she's referring to both. She's referring to the hased of Boaz, but she's referring ultimately to the hased of God who is working through Boaz. See, God's preferred method of getting things done is to work through his image bearers. So God's hased love comes to Naomi through her daughter-in-law and now also through Boaz. For a woman who had seemingly lost all hope, this one day's events sparks in her a return of hope, a belief that the God that she said had turned against her had actually not ever abandoned his hased for her. Then Naomi drops the biggest piece of information yet. Boaz is their close relative, guardian redeemer. A guardian redeemer is a person obligated by the law to care for vulnerable family members and buy back or repossess their family's land if possible. Naomi now has good reason to expect that Boaz will even redeem Ruth, an action that would provide both widows with the security they need. And I think Phil's going to talk on more of that next week. Boaz's hased changed the trajectory of Naomi's life, restored her hope. What gave her that hope? It was an ephah of barley. And the providence of God that Ruth ended up in Boaz's field. Well, that's quite a good haul of barley and a really good providential provision. You know, it doesn't seem like much compared to the years of loss and tragedy and disappointment she's experienced. Remember, Naomi has lost her husband, buried both of her sons. She has been a refugee in Moab for many, many, many years, and she comes back to her hometown penniless, husbandless, with nothing. It's just one good day, and all of a sudden she starts to get this excitement. But sometimes it doesn't take much to restore hope. Sometimes it only takes a small kindness or a glimmer of goodness to restore a person's hope. I remember when Lori was first diagnosed with cancer, there was a lot of things that we were grieving. But one of those things was that we had planned a family trip to Mexico. And of course, you plan a trip like that way ahead of time, and it was our Christmas present to the kids, but we didn't find out about this until February, March, and the trip was coming up. And it just so happened that the surgery to remove the tumor was going to be just days before we were supposed to travel to Mexico. And so, of course, the surgeon said, "You can't go to Mexico. You can't fly after surgery." And Lori was praying that there would be a way for this trip to still go ahead, so we didn't cancel it. And I, of course, I'm going to preach on doubt in the summer. And, of course, I was doubtful. Sometimes I think, who do you identify most in the Bible? I'm like, you know that man who said, "I believe, Lord, help my unbelief"? I think that's my guy I identify with. And I was like, you can pray, but I don't know how in the world that's going to happen. On the day of her surgery, so Lori was praying, and she had these moments with the Lord where she felt like the Lord is saying, "No, the door is open, the door is open, something's going to happen," and I'm like, okay. On the day of her surgery, Lori mentioned her hope of going to Mexico with her family to the surgeon. And as she was waking up out of anesthesia, the surgeon said, "I think you'll recover well down in Mexico," giving her that okay. And at first when I heard that, I was like, are you sure? Like, pretty loopy after your comment. Like, you... maybe that was like a fever dream. But she's like, no, he told me to take aspirin before I got on the plane. He told me I got to walk around a lot. I'm like, okay, probably not a figment of your imagination. That's probably true. So that happened. And you know what? In the grand scheme of everything that Lori was going to have to go through, chemotherapy and radiation and years of medication and uncertainty about the rates of reoccurrence, going to Mexico probably doesn't seem like that much. But it was that glimmer of hope, that evidence that God has not stopped showing his hased. And so for Naomi, it takes only one day of kindness to her daughter-in-law that awakens Naomi's awareness of God's faithfulness and presence. When just a day earlier she had declared herself as bitter, she now sees he has not stopped showing his chesed. And how has God shown his chesed? Through Boaz, whose actions prove that God's love has not failed or abandoned her. So this is the takeaway for us. Chesed is not just a nice, fluffy concept or a conceptual idea of what love could look like in its ideal form or what God's love is, hypothetically speaking. God's chesed is meant to be lived out by us, like Boaz does here, like Ruth did with Naomi last week. We experience God's chesed love not only in our experiences with God, but in our experiences with others who tangibly live out chesed. And the basis for life as God's covenant people rests upon our ability to live out the principles of chesed love to one another. Again, look at the laws of Leviticus. How does God want his nation to be run? How does God want people in Israel to treat one another? Well, the gleaning of the fields. Leave things behind for the foreigners in the land. We can think of laws that tell them to return all the property and land that they have purchased to the original families every 50 years so that no family falls into generational poverty. Think about the instruction in Leviticus 25. If any of your fellow Israelites become poor and are unable to support themselves among you, help them as you would a foreigner and a stranger so that they can continue to live among you. Do not take any interest or any profit from them, but fear your God so that they may continue to live among you. You must not lend them money at interest or even sell them food at a profit. That's a fairly radical way to run a society, isn't it? That's how God expects his covenant people to live. God cares about how we treat one another, especially the poor and the vulnerable in our midst, because this is chesed. We are to say, I will sacrifice my desire for more wealth to make sure others have what they need. I will sacrifice my time so that others know they can depend on me. I will extend extravagant kindness, mercy, and grace to those I happen to meet. And when you think of all that God has done for you, you should think, I have been so blessed so that I can be a blessing. That's the call. God's community of chesed love continues into his new spiritual family, all those who come to him through faith in Jesus. We see chesed love in the community in the early church, don't we? In the very first church in Acts chapter 2, all the believers met together in one place and they shared everything they had. They sold their property and their possessions and they shared money with those in need. They worshiped together at the temple each day, meeting in homes for the Lord's Supper, sharing their meals with great joy and generosity, all the while praising God and enjoying the goodwill of all the people. James 1:27 reminds us that religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this, to look after orphans and widows in their distress. Chesed love even calls us to love those who hate us. Jesus says, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, and pray for those who mistreat you. So how does God envision his people living? He sees them as embodying chesed, as Ruth did when she refused to leave her mother-in-law, as Boaz did when he went beyond the letter of the law to the very heart of the law and extended generosity, kindness, and inclusion to a foreign woman from an enemy nation. I'm going to call the worship team up as we close. We are, like Boaz, to be God's agents of chesed in this world, so that those who are like Naomi, those in darkness and tragedy, can see the glimmer of light that is God's saving grace, so that those like Ruth can be cared for and warmly welcomed, no matter who they are or where they come from. Jesus tells us, you are the light of the world. So let your light shine before others, that they might see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. Boaz did four things that allowed him to share chesed with Ruth and Naomi that we can apply to our own lives. And just think about this week. What did Boaz do to apply chesed? He noticed. Before he helped Ruth, he noticed her. And so who in your life is easy to overlook, or who have you overlooked that you need to start to notice? He protected. Boaz used his position and influence to create safety. So where can you use your influence to stand beside someone who's vulnerable or excluded? He provided. Boaz didn't ask, what's the minimum I have to do? He went beyond the letter of the law to bless Ruth generously. How can you choose generosity instead of simply meeting the expectations? And number four, he included. Boaz invites Ruth to eat with everyone else. He moves her from the margins of society to the very table. So who could you intentionally invite, include, or welcome this week who needs that spot of belonging. I'm going to leave you with that this week. I'm going to invite you to stand as I pray, and then we'll close with our closing song. Heavenly Father, your love is steadfast and sure. Your love is never failing. Your love is always being poured out into our hearts by the Spirit. And so I pray that as those who have been recipients of your love and your grace, your mercy and your kindness, your faithfulness and steadfastness, that we would be those who would go out into our world to be the light of the world as you were the light of the world. As you are sent, so we are sent. And so, Lord, I pray for opportunities to show your chesed. And I pray that you would give us that ability to dig deep within ourselves by your Spirit at work within us, by the love that you have poured out into us, that we would love our neighbors as ourselves deeply, to show them that you are a God of grace and love and mercy and kindness. And I pray that that would be seen in us. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.